Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. Alex Katz was born in Brooklyn, New York in 1927 and educated at Cooper Union. Although he fraternized in the 1950s with the abstract expressionists, Katz never embraced the gestural style popular in New York, clinging instead to some degree of observation. Yet if Katz's work has always celebrated the realism of quotidian life and landscape, it also incorporates the scale and structure of the ambitious abstract painting of his time. In 1968, Katz moved to an artist cooperative building in Soho, where he has lived and worked ever since. Although he is best known for his figure paintings, often set in and around Manhattan, Katz is equally a painter of Maine, where he has summered for decades. Represented by 89 works in the gallery's collection, Katz's career can be traced through generous gifts like Folding Chair, 1959, and Isaac and Oliver, 2013, and important acquisitions such as Swamp Maple, 430, 1968. Most recently, he was commissioned to enhance Manhattan's 57th Street, 6th Avenue subway station interior with Metropolitan Faces, a series of his iconic, brightly colored portraits and flower paintings. Katz was also approved to place a series of cutout sculptures of his wife, Ada, on the median of New York's Park Avenue. In this conversation, held on March 9, 2019, as part of the Diamondstein Spielvogel Lecture Series, Katz and National Gallery of Art senior curator Harry Cooper discussed the genesis and evolution of Katz's practice over 50 years.
So great to have you here. I'm Harry Cooper, senior curator of modern art, speaking with a gentleman named Alex Katz. And we have a couple of special guests in the audience as well. You're all special guests. But we have Alex's wife, Ada, with us right down front. More recognizable than Alex. And we also have the new director of the National Gallery, Kaywin Feldman, is here. And her husband, Jim Lutz, is here with her. So I think this is her first public appearance, semi-public appearance at the gallery. I want to thank Dr. Barbara Lee Diamondstein Spielvogel and Ambassador Carl Spielvogel. They have endowed this series of lectures, which brings distinguished contemporary artists here to speak with us. So we've got a lot of ground to cover. Alex was born in 1927, if you can believe that. He and Ada have been married over 60 years, and good for both of you. Amazing. Yeah, why not? Why not? So I want to look at a lot of things, and not just your whole life and your whole career, but some other things too. But as I said, born in Brooklyn, 1927, but Queens is where you grew up. You're a Queens guy, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. Your parents were Jewish from Russia and spoke Yiddish. How's your Yiddish?
Well, they cut it off.
They stopped speaking Yiddish? Yeah. Okay.
To me.
Okay. Why?
Well, my father believed in assimilation. Mm-hmm. And my mother was having me recite poetry young, and my father didn't like it at all.
So Yiddish poetry,
yeah,
or Russian poetry?
He cut off foreign languages and told me to go out and play in the street.
Okay. The painting we're looking at on the screen is a wonderful and important early painting promised to us by Irving and Lucy Sandler. Irving passed away, a couple of years ago?
A month ago.
Just a few months ago.
Something like that.
And in fact, in the New York Times, this wonderful picture of them in front of Alex's portrait was published. So this is really the moment when you get started. Is that fair to say?
Well, everyone says so.
Do you agree? No. When did you get started?
1950. Well, they were more experimental, but they were totally non-negotiable. But these were the first paintings that were negotiable.
Commercially negotiable.
Intellectually negotiable.
Okay. I stand corrected already. So, why don't you tell us then how you got to this point?
I decided very early on that I wanted to make a new kind of realistic painting. And it was like not a very practical idea, because the old realistic paintings, just they couldn't see what I was doing at all. It was like unfinished paintings. And to the abstract expressionists, it was retro. I was told when I first showed a painting, figuration is obsolete and color is French, you know? And that was the world I was in. But I had the idea what I wanted to do. It was instinctive. It was following instincts, and my instincts was much stronger than anything logical. So I proceeded, and what I noticed was the big problem in the United States was I went to an advanced art school, Cooper Union. It was either a regional painting or provincial modern art, you know? And so the regional painting was like out of the question for me, because I went to a modern art school. And
so when you say regional, you're talking about what kind of things?
Oh, Hopper.
Edward Hopper, okay.
And what are the Thomas Art Benton. Brothers, what?
Benton.
Huh?
Thomas
yeah,
Art
Benton.
Benton,
all of that. Mm-hmm. Grant Wood.
Albright, okay.
Albright, yeah, mm-hmm. All that stuff. You just, once you started on the modern thing with Cézanne and Picasso, that stuff was, didn't make any sense at all.
And what do you mean by the other alternative was provincial modernism?
What?
So
like provincial modernism. Well, I'll tell you the story. My wife and I go to the Whitney Museum, and they have a big show of pre-war modern art. My wife walks in the room and says, "Ah, the Picasso room."
And it's not Picasso.
No, it's Whitney. It's all the American artists.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was the story. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's Picasso everywhere. And you wanted to get around Picasso and Matisse, you know? And I noticed that neither one of them dealt with really specific details. They generalized. And at the same time, I really liked a lot of abstract painting. And so I developed the idea of the flat background, which is like a place to put a figure with specific details.
So, Alex, this is some of the painting
that was
available
going around at
to
time,
you. And you know, more than available, everybody was doing it in the early 1950s.
Yeah, yeah,
right?
That was, de Kooning was the king downtown. And when they had the stable annual, they would have like 12 de Koonings in, and one of his, you know. And Gustin was very popular, it was all generalized. So the thing with the specific details changed it. And the hardest part of the Irving and Lucy painting with the flat backgrounds was painting the background, making the background plausible so it wasn't like paper, you know. It was atmosphere. You know, and that was like what was Mondrian, a little bit of it, Rothko, the colorist, they put a color down, and he put enough of it down, it opened up and became atmospheric. So Irving and Lucy with the feet sets it in perspective, and the white goes all around them. It isn't like they're cut out and pasted on the canvas. And there was, and that was it. That was it. And then that started off, and you have it in your head. You think you could do it, and you put it on a wall, and people tell you what they think about it, and it changes and alters what you're doing. You can't possibly know what you're doing if you're extending yourself, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so the painting is like a part of everybody around, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. including the bad reviewers.
Now, Irving Sandler, we associate him with the abstract expressionists because of that book he wrote, The Triumph of American Painting, but he was also very involved with your kind of painting as well.
Well, Irving got a job in the Tanager Gallery, which is a co-op, and he sat behind the desk there, and everyone came in there, and they argued all the time, and Irving listened, but all the painters in the Tanager were like younger than the abstract expressionists, mm-hmm. and they were all going in a different direction. By 1954, if you dripped, it was really old-fashioned.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, the fashion in painting changes every 3 years. It's like the record business.
So these were painters like Philip Perlstein, Charles Cajori, Tom Wesselman.
Well, they're later.
They're later. Tanager.
Yeah, they're, okay. They're really later in styling.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. This is 1958.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And there was nothing around anything like it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the most biggest show of my life was that mm-hmm. was that show in the Tanager.
Now I want to ask you about something that happened very soon after this, but first I wanted to include this beautiful drawing of your mother, which we just realized was here in the collection. Tell us a couple of things about your mother.
Oh, my mother was an actress, and she was the star on the Jewish stage. And I left the straight world and I went to high school. I went to a vocational high school and drew from the antique for 3 years, which just happened to be there. I looked at the antique drawings, and I really liked them. And so you could do whatever you wanted, so I just drew from them and had a very good teacher. So I drew from the antique for 3 years. And at the end of that, I could do a drawing that was as good as any adult's in the city, and it was completely useless. I mean, it was just a system. I mean, yeah, the subway token, mm-hmm. you can get uptown. That's
must have given you a real foundation and to be able to do a drawing like this.
Well, this is after that. This is, I got out in 45, this is like 1946. And this is before I went to Cooper Union, and I did this, and it was when I see it, it's like a pretty good drawing. I'm 19 at that time, and then I'm about to learn modern art.
Mm-hmm. Her eyes are closed.
Her eyes are closed,
interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. You think she's reading or sleeping?
I don't know. She wasn't sleeping. Mm-hmm. I don't know what she was doing.
I want to read you one quote from your informal autobiography. At the back, you have some stories about your mother. And you say, "My mother's English and wit were definitely superior to mine. Once, while taking leave of her in a hotel lobby, I said, 'It's been awfully nice talking to you.' She replied, 'I hope you don't paint in cliches.'"
Yeah, Mama was really sharp, and I never won in dialogue. There was a bunch of them. They were really pretty wild. I said I was going to have a show. I came home. I did 60 paintings this summer, and she said, "I hope you 1 year you're doing one." And that ended up being the lawn party. And
take her advice. You didn't take her advice. You kept doing 60 paintings.
No. The next time I did one,
oh,
the lawn
party.
Oh, you
did one painting.
It killed
me.
I did one painting, and she was right. The painting got me a bad review that was as good as any de Kooning ever had. And I was just, you know, cut this big in the Times, and saying how I lost my character. I used to be a good painter, and now I was selling out, you know, the real character assassination. And it took half the page of the, it was in a group show, and it took half the page of the Times. And I called my mother, and she said, "Oh, it's about time someone got interested in you." So, she was right. Another thing she did.
So this was another option that was available.
Yeah,
and
that
this
was
made
it.
A big difference to you.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Jackson Pollock just opened it all up. Braque and Matisse and everyone else was painting with black lines in closing form. And Jackson Pollock just opened it up, and so did Bonnard. Bonnard was painting a field of light. And that's the way to go. You want to get around Picasso and Matisse, and this is the avenue. And also, by the end of the 50s, I said, well, maybe we can make a large-scale figurative painting, you know? Mm-hmm. And took that jump. Mm-hmm. And it's like my life was, you get a series of opportunities that you think. And I didn't have a lot of confidence, I had a lot of nerve, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think in my family, I'm the sissy of the family. They were outrageous. My mother took a car up 7th Avenue against the traffic for 8 blocks because someone objected to her driving. Can you imagine doing that at night against the traffic for 8 blocks and making a joke to the cop, and the cop said, "Don't do it again." So they were like that, and the father dove over bridges. It was a he-man. And, gee, I realized I didn't. That was beyond me completely.
You say he dove off bridges?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
As a hobby.
Yeah, for the hell of it.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Well, you know what it is? It's like a He-Man has to show the other guys that they're not up to it. So he'd go off the bridge and no other guys would. Stuff like that, you know.
But you're very competitive. You're tough.
I'm tough, yeah, but and competitive, but mousy compared to my family.
Okay. So a couple other things about Pollock. One thing you said, I think, was that, and this is, it's very counterintuitive that Alex Katz would be so turned on by Pollock. But you also said this made you want to do plein air painting, to paint outside.
Well, plein air painting came as an accident. I studied modern art and actually was really, really good at it at the time. I was doing very fashionable paintings. I showed one, I got a nice review in the Times. Then I went to the Scouting and Art School, which was regional, and they were giving a real bad time on modern art. And they had a truck, and I went out and tried painting, and
so
it was electric.
So this is Skowhegan, if people don't know, is up in Maine, and now people go there on fellowships, but you went there 2 summers on scholarship as a student, and you were really taking classes and learning.
Well, it was very, very informal.
Okay.
But I got the thing of like painting out. It was painting a landscape. It was like painting automatically. Mm-hmm. Because I painted a lot of paintings I made were from photographs at that time too. And the process of painting automatically freed me from cast drawing, cubism, and everything I learned, you know, it was really explosive, and it didn't make any sense with what was going on, but it made a lot of sense at the end of 10 years.
What do you mean by automatically?
Well, the base of like cubism stuff is like it's like a system, like the cubism is like cast drawing. It's the same system actually, and everything inside the system. You work. Once you get outside the system, it's something else. And I thought of cubism, which was the basis of Cooper Union, cubism and Bauhaus. And I thought of just another system. I didn't take it seriously. I said, let's do it and learn it. And after I get out of art school, I'll figure out what I want to do. I didn't take my art school seriously as art. You know, the drawing my mother thought was art, but the stuff I did in art school was. When I went to art school, I figured, well, this teacher can paint better than me now. And I told the first painting teacher, I told the guy next to me, if I can't paint better than this in 2 years, I'll eat the paint box. And I was dead serious. And and up until that time, my life was all over the place. And then when I got to Cooper Union, I started working on drawings around the clock. I mean, when I wasn't eating, I was drawing, and drawing at 4 a.m. on the train. I was drawing everywhere and did a lot of drawing and got pretty good at the end of 3 years because I couldn't draw fast at all when I got there. So I learned a lot, and in 3 years I went from being incompetent to being competent in modern art. And I said, if I can do this, if I advance this much in 3 years, in 20 years I think I can make some real art. And it worked out.
Now, I'm not going to forget my question. Automatically.
Automatic means like you just get in front of it, you start painting.
What you see, not caring about design, composition.
No composition, nothing, just painting what you see.
Okay.
And it's pretty much like a child, except I have muscle memory from the cast drawing and the cubism.
Okay.
So things come out okay.
Yeah.
I don't have to think about it.
So we're looking at a wonderful painting which we acquired from you a few years ago because I saw it in your studio and I said we've got to have it. And you held on to it for us. I appreciate it. Portrait of Ada, 1959. You've been married now for 1 year, I think.
Yeah.
And is this an automatic painting?
Yeah, the model's in front of you, and you just like paint.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all very direct. And like I said, I didn't know this painting was that good. He said it was. And then it was shown, and everyone reproduced it. So they agreed with it. But a lot of times, I have no idea whether the thing's any good. Just know I'm finished with it.
Well, maybe you're too close
to
it.
And this is like from the thing you saw of Irving Sandler. This is, again, the background, and she's in it.
Right. And another thing you said about Pollock and the all-over style was, let's cool it, just put it in the middle.
Oh, yeah.
Which seems to apply
Central.
Here.
Yeah.
Right?
Stick in the middle.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's a big
difference.
It's
like Bonnie Newman.
Mm-hmm.
Figuring ground.
Mm-hmm.
Bonnie Newman's not stripe, it's figuring ground. They have different weights, you know? So you have a Washington show there with a man, I forget his name, does all these stripes. Those are stripes. Bonnie Newman's zip is not a stripe. It's a weight difference. And this is similar to that.
And in a way, I think, yes, there's figuring ground, but that ground is just as strong as the figure, and it's not really behind the figure, and there's a lot of...
It's right, it's in, inside of it, yeah.
Yeah, it's really all figure, or all ground.
Well, by this time, this is like a little bit later than the Irving Sandler picture. I was more proficient at dealing with it.
I mean, this painting, one thing I love about it is we can see you've got your wet-on-wet technique going. This is one-shot painting, and just the way you like bring that lock of hair down to create volume. It's you know, just beautifully fluid. You just seem to be completely in the medium, in the moment, and it looks easy. I don't know if it's easy. Probably not.
59.
You make it look easy.
59. See, yeah. Irving was in Lucy's 58. This is a whole year later.
So one of the big changes here is with Irving and Lucy, they're in the middle of the whole thing. Here, Ada is cropped, she's cut off. And I think this is a big change in your work.
This is still, the figuring ground is still in traditional scale. The scale changes in 1962.
60s, yeah.
I decided I wanted to make an image that was not traditional. And I was looking at a lot of movies and TV and billboards, and they had large scale. They had large faces, and they'd have. And I used to go to movies to see westerns. I was carving frames and finish work, run into the movies, and just walk in. And there were westerns. You see a big face here and a lot of land over here, and I said, that's for me. Yeah. And because there was no reference to traditional art, where up until that point, the figure on the ground, you could relate them to Goya or other people. Mm-hmm. And I went into this large scale. And at the time, I wanted to be able to make something that had the velocity of a de Kooning, you know? And in this scale, I couldn't.
Mm-hmm. So this painting, did you all see it before you came in? 2 feet by 2 feet?
Yeah.
Oil on board?
Yeah, it was small, and I was painting small through.
But it looks pretty good up there, too.
Yeah. But still, it didn't have the muscle. Mm-hmm. I saw the Kooning show in 58, and he had the Daughter of the River there, and I thought the show was fantastic. Mm-hmm. And I said to myself, I want to knock him off the wall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You're tough.
Yeah, tough. Yeah. So I do these big faces, and they would hold their own with any de Kooning.
Mm-hmm. So
I'm and muscle, and just in muscle. I'm not talking about quality. I'm talking about muscle. Mm-hmm.
I'm going to keep after you here about this cropping, because I think the fact that you cut the figure off there is a big change. And this is also a time when you begin to make cutouts, right? Which are your figures, and I think we have some images of those. This is a much later one.
It's much
that
later.
We have, but those are some.
Those
of the,
are later too.
But some of the characters really, that you knew.
But you start cropping. You can see on those they're cut at very irregular places. Because when I first did it, I went through all the original endings of sculpture. And it's kind of arbitrary, but sculptures end at here, like the one of Ada. They end here, you know. And they end here sometimes.
And these are ending in all the wrong places.
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, that's right. It's like in the Cubist things, you paint the space in front of the figure, you know. And to make something really go around, Rembrandt does it too. You paint the space here and the space back here, and you really get volume. And if you look at a Rembrandt, he does it. He's painting the space behind to make volume. And with the Cubist thing, they cut it off, and I said, well, these are like Cubists. You cut it off, and the space comes right up to the edge of it, and you make something that I hadn't seen before. Mm. And that was it. You want to go into... Want to do things that look new. Don't want anything that looks old.
I have a theory that you might have inspired Frank Stella to cut out the corners of his stripe canvases.
I don't think so.
Well, you did your first cutouts where you were cutting out the space around the figure in 1959. He did his first in 1960.
Yeah, well.
But if he were here, I'm sure he would be objecting to that.
I think he would. Well, I don't want to say it.
Is this a Frank Stella story coming?
No, it's the same sort of thing. When Chuck Close had his first show, it was a big sensation with these big faces. And Al Hell was there, and he was his teacher. And he said, I owe this to you. And Al said, don't lay that shit on me.
Okay.
So something like that.
We're live streaming and we cannot edit. So another wonderful painting in our collection, a gift from your foundation. Seems like when we buy something, we get a gift. It's a good deal. Folding chair from 1959, and there you are a couple of years later. And at this point, you have discovered Lincolnville, Maine, for a few years now, and you're going up there for long summers and then going back to the city. Is that a little Edward Hopper peeking out, a little regionalism peeking out of that window there?
A little bit like Hopper, I guess.
But not too much.
Not too much.
Okay.
It's much flatter, and the paint is very direct.
Yeah, yeah.
That is much more pizzazz.
I stand corrected. We thought about hanging this at the top of this here, too. This one is 4 feet by 4 feet, but Ada, at half the size, you know, yeah, just had the punch that she won, you know. But this is a great gallery painting. The first thing I did actually when I got this job in 2008 was buy this painting Swamp Maple, which you had released onto the market. Not sure why, but I'm glad you did. And this was my first acquisition here, and I hope some of you have seen it in the galleries. When we reopened, I created a tree room with Swamp Maple and some Mario Mertz trees and a Cecily Brown tree and a few other trees. And here it is.
That's what it was.
In Maine. You saw this every meal in Maine for years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So thank you. What's there now?
What's where?
At that, where the painting was.
Oh, a green painting with the leaves. Mm-hmm. That I hope stays there.
But let's talk about the Swamp Maple for
Late. It's 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
4:30.
4:30.
Yeah.
And the sun.
That's in the title.
Yeah. I started at 4.
I started
well,
at 4.
Well, the paintings are basically all the paintings. A lot of them have to do with a specific time, a specific light, and the impressionist paintings have a slower time. They don't have a fast light. And I like the light from de Kooning and Pollock. It's fast. And I wanted to make the immediacy of perception the goal. And so this is painted at 4:30. And the sun is going down. It's a hazy day in August. And it's backlit the tree. So the tree turns black, dark. And it's just painting what's in front of you. But that's the idea. And the tree is dark because the light's against it, and the softness is a damp day. So the sky is sort of yellowish, and it's a reflection from the sun that's on the lake. It makes it kind of whitish, and the pale blue is off in the distance, and it's just matching colors.
So
it's all perception, and it has to do with an additional problem of my work was the fact is, what is realism? You see it with your eyes and you think it's real, but actually you see things culturally. And what you see is usually 20 years behind where I am. So I'm seeing this as I want it, and you see it as, people saw it as not viable as a painting and not realistic either. Mm-hmm. And actually, I had people screaming in galleries. Very few paintings have had that. People have had that honor to have people screaming at the work. And I had it in France in 1975, and I had it in Provincetown in 1960. People actually were screaming that this is terrible and I should go back to art school. But that's it with realism.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I have on my Alex Katz quotation list is, there's nothing more mysterious than appearances.
Absolutely. Well, that's it. Because you're trying to see it the way it is now, not the way it was 20 years ago. And with that, there's a thing I use all the time. When I grew up, Washington Square was a weak impressionist watercolor. That's how you saw it. And now if you go to see Washington Square, it's like something you've seen in TV. And your vision has been altered by TV. And photography and TV are the dominant forces in what you see. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't have your vision, you have the vision of your culture.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's a lot to think about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is. Well,
yeah, it is.
These are not simple paintings.
Yeah. Well, just to get back to this one for a minute, I think what I, now this was not a quick painting, right? This is not, you have to
take it back
to the studio for all those leaves, right? You can't do that quickly.
Oh, I made drawings.
You know, lots of drawings.
I made lots of drawings, yes. And drew it all on the canvas, mm-hmm. and then painted it.
There's pencil underneath.
Yeah, there's a drawing under every mm-hmm. leaf.
Yeah.
And then I painted it up. I painted it in a day, I guess.
Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. One thing I love about it is the way the tree and the branches and leaves reach out, sort of touching, sort of feeling for the edges of the canvas. I feel there's something anthropomorphic about it. It's like a portrait of a tree.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. It's very specific.
Yeah.
The later ones are more generalized.
Yeah.
Do you have that painting, the other one?
That's,
or is that a print?
That's a print we do have in our collection, which is much later, but it shows you turning those leaves in the same way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Another thing about this painting, if you look at it closely in the bark, there's a beautiful, subtle craquelure pattern of cracks, and that really sold me on it. I thought that was a brilliant way to convey the bark until you told me that happened later.
Well, it happened almost. It was quickly,
drying cracks.
Yeah, what happened was it was very hot when I was painting it, and I was painting it in a barn that was had a fairly low ceiling, so it must have been over 100 degrees when I was painting that thing, and I'm putting a black on top of a light, and it's like lean over fat, which is not sound. And so what happened was it made those white lines all over, and they look great, so we let it go.
Okay.
It hasn't changed. If something looks good, don't fool mm-hmm. with it.
Yeah. We'll get off of this in a minute, but just to mention the cropping again, you have violated the primary rule of painting trees, which is you're supposed to show them rooted, you know, where they are on the ground, and you don't care about that. You also put the tree right in the middle. You're not supposed to do that. It's supposed to be on the side, so it's a repoussoir, so you get the space. You're breaking all the rules.
Yeah. Well, I always did.
Here are a few more trees.
Well.
Cézanne, Courbet.
Yeah. I started with Cézanne, actually.
You started with Cézanne.
Yeah, when I started mm-hmm. painting outdoors, he was controlling my vision. And actually, they had a show in... Yeah, the outlines on the trees are traditional in European painting, the way they make volumes by curves. And then there's volumes inside. And he was the first painter I really liked because I liked the emotional force of the painting when I was a teenager. I first saw him. And then they presented him as this big intellectual, you know. But I liked him for the emotional force, and I thought I didn't know what I was. No, I wasn't sure of myself. But later, when I got more confidence, I realized, oh, that was the thing of him, not the structural things which people talk about.
Yeah.
I saw this show in Philadelphia, and then I'm looking at some of the paintings, and he just overpainted stuff. You have like the system of painting, and I started painting like Braque, which is layers of paint, dry on dry, and you scumble on the top. And then when I got free, I started painting with washes on hard grounds, like, you know, hard surfaces. It's wet on dry. And then I painted, when I went back to canvas, it was a little, not quite fat. It was lean on dry. And then I started fooling around with painting in the park in layers. That was really wet and wet. Mm-hmm. And what I would do, go to the park across the street, you layer the one color on and you keep dropping paint into it. It was sort of like what they call schlock painting. Technique. You get things done very fast. Mm-hmm. And that was part of the technique. And I think I had done those big faces at that time. It was 1964. And at 4 a.m, Franco Howe was there telling me, you shouldn't be doing these little things. You should be painting big faces like the Red Smile and things like that. And I said, listen, Frank, I know how good I am. And he said, don't get porky with me. He said, you're going to hang next to Matisse. And that was a real downer.
An earlier
painting. Oh, the first one on the right. I was very proud of that picture. Mm-hmm. It's a white gesso ground on Mason. I didn't want the texture of canvas would soften the strokes. So the strokes are really direct. And it's a white piece of thing and black lines on it, and that's it. And mm-hmm. that was shocking to me because they're coming from painting like Braque with layers and layers, and I got to that. Mm-hmm. I really felt that was like fantastic mm-hmm. for me. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. direct. Yeah. And I sort of at the end of the fifth, at the end of, near the end of the 50s, I was in a cafeteria at 4 a.m, and some guy's saying, I'm trying to get the expressions in the eyes right. And I'm thinking, that's the wildest thing I ever heard coming from high modern art. And I said, well, maybe I should try it. And that's when I started doing the specific details mm-hmm. in the portraits. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And had a lot to do with painting Ada. I just met Ada, and she had to transition from a more generalized way to really more specific. And I painted all winter. At the end of the winter, I got something I really liked. Mm-hmm. That was the way it went. Mm-hmm. And well, this is double portraits. And this started with Al Held and George Sugarman were like Hegelian modernists. In other words, they believed in progress in art. You know, which is, to me, I never felt art got better. I felt it's always sort of the same. But Hegel thought, why don't we start now and relate the old guys to the news? Because Germany was just deadened by academic painting at that time. So he's kind of a great guy, but he believed in progress, and so the story was, George wouldn't speak to Al for 2 years because Al overlapped the plane. Yeah?
He created space and you were supposed to be flat.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is Everything George Sugarman, a sculptor that you might not have heard of, an Al Held painter. Yeah.
So it was, every form was supposed to be autonomous with George. Mm-hmm. And I realized that I was timid about overlapping forms. So when I heard that, I said, let's overlap volumes right away.
You sure did. You sure did.
That was it, overlapping volumes. Yeah. And I would always say, thank you, George. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. How do you like that?
That's great.
And I was using sissy colors, too. A real man paints with red, yellow, and blue.
Uh-huh. And so, Vincent, you're only child. He's born around 1960, I think, so he's about 7 years old here, up in Maine. Another painting from our collection, which came by way of the Corcoran, of a great figure in Washington, D.C., Evelyn Neff. And you knew her? How did this
come
about?
Yeah, she was amazing. Mm-hmm. Amazing lady.
And her husband, John, Ambassador Neff.
She was brilliant, and she could do anything. And she met this guy, last husband, and he is French, so she went to Columbia and learned French in a couple of months.
Wow.
I mean, she's really dynamite. Mm-hmm. And for this, I made a great drawing. I like the drawing better than the
drawing,
painting.
Which is also in our collection.
Yeah.
And so you made a very careful drawing.
Very careful drawing. And made the painting, but I prefer the drawing.
Yeah.
It's more open.
And she is known to us primarily for the great Chagall mosaic that was in her Georgetown backyard, and then she bequeathed it to the gallery. It's in our sculpture garden right now. We have lots of Alex's prints and drawings in the collection, which fill in, you could say, some of the 70s and 80s where we don't have paintings. It's a great series. And then recently, you gave us this really lovely portrait of your two grandsons. So we got another generation going here. Vincent's two sons, Isaac and Oliver, painted in 2013. And I saw this in your studio too. And in fact, I met one of the boys and saw these two great sketches that you made. And this might be a time to talk a little about your process, because you have quite a traditional series of steps going on.
Well, at the end of the 50s, I decided I wanted to paint big, so I went up to 6x6. So I found myself in the middle of a road painting a landscape of the road. And it's a tar road with cars, and they didn't come too often. So I painted this painting, and it was successful. And I says, you can't go on like this. You know,
you want to get killed.
Big. What?
You could get killed.
Well, not only can you get killed, you can lose control of making a painting.
Okay.
And
even worse.
Even worse. So then I changed a good painting, or you change your ideas. You know. You just follow the painting. And the first one was, I did a double portrait of Ada twice, Ada in 1959, I guess. And I wanted to make a non-psychological double portrait. So I made her and repeated her. And it's the first repetitive figurative thing ever, you know, like that. And I knew the painting was pretty good or interesting. And so I changed my idea of direct painting. At that minute, I said, well, this altered your life. You forget your ideas and just go ahead. You follow the painting, not your ideas. And so when I started to paint, wanted to paint larger to get the velocity of the AE guys, that really power.
Abstract expressionists.
Yeah. So I started to paint these big faces. But what I did was paint a painting direct, like I would any other painting before. And then it was okay this big, let's try it this big. And then we tried this big, let's try it 4 feet. It looks good 4 feet, let's go 6x6. And that's the way I started. So it was indirect. And I found that if I draw on the canvas, I couldn't keep the colors real clean. So I started to draw on paper, perforate it, and push pigment through it. Mm-hmm. So I have a real clean surface. So now I'm going way from what I originally saw, which was direct painting. The direct painting was just the start.
Yeah, so and this is an example of the kind of
collage. I mean, that's the cartoons which go on top of the canvas, and I make my drawing from that. Mm-hmm. So from real direct stuff, it goes to really indirect. Mm-hmm. But when I paint a painting now, the drawings on the canvas usually, or even some of the late ones, I didn't even make a drawing. I have the colors all mixed. The sequence of the colors is in my head, and the brushes are all laid out. So it's just a matter of execution. So I can make a very large painting that has a very direct surface, you know, and it's, I don't know, it's a more lively surface than just about anyone's, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, because of the process. Mm-hmm. And it's a terrific strain painting it, because it's all done real quick. And you just have to trust your instincts pretty much on it, you know. And the very light landscapes, which he'll be showing, I just threw away the idea of even a sketch. I mean, I had little sketches this big on some of them. I knew they would work out big, and the ones that didn't, that work in between.
So this, just to clarify, this is called pouncing, right?
What?
Pouncing, where you...
Yeah, pounce.
You pounce it. So you have the life-size drawing on the craft paper, you put it on the canvas, and with a tool, you poke a series of little holes along the contour.
Yeah, put holes on it, and you push pigment through it. Then I draw on top of that, and if it doesn't look good, I'll adjust the drawing.
Yeah. You know? And you got this from Giotto, right?
Yeah, straight from Giotto.
Yeah. Yes, it's an old technique. But in a way, you're saying that for all of that careful preparation, the spontaneity gets preserved in the act of painting.
Yeah,
right?
The painting is all
where
direct.
It's all happening.
Well, I didn't want any new... In New York, there was a lot of second-generation noodle painting. And it's like fussy painting, and I wanted direct painting. And it came from a misunderstanding of Matisse. So I saw Matisse when I was really young. I thought the paintings were like fantastic, and I thought they were direct. But actually, I did not realize how much he planned them. So I was going off making these terrible paintings that were very direct. I destroyed 1,000 paintings in my 50s.
You destroyed 1,000 paintings?
Yeah.
Do you mean you painted over them, or
I just busted them up and threw them in the fireplace.
Good canvas. Good.
No canvas. They were all in masonite.
Masonite. That's a lot of masonite.
That's a lot of masonite.
Yeah.
What was important was I got a great technique. After 10 years, my technique was really good, but by 1959 I could really paint, and the paintings weren't important.
Mm-hmm. So here you are. This is drawing on canvas now, and then you'll...
Well, I'm going over a pounce line.
Over the pouncing to get the drawing, and then you'll paint over that.
Yeah, that's right.
But the charcoal will stay under?
That's... I don't know what the heck I was doing.
Because that would...
The process. Looks like I'm drawing right on
that
it. That might have been paper.
Maybe that's
that might
paper, because you don't want to dirty up the
paper,
right?
It looks like white paper, really. I don't believe I wouldn't draw like that on a canvas.
Okay. Yeah, because then your paints would get
dirty. Yeah, it's dirty.
Yeah. Okay, cleared that up. So you have a show coming up at the Gavin Brown Enterprise, which is an amazing, huge space up in Harlem, big enough for you. And so we were in your studio looking at some of these paintings, which are going to be shown there, and I was shocked, but that you're doing Degas now, homage to Degas.
Well,
yes.
But I was at the Met, and I'm looking at these Degas sculptures, and I just think he's a fantastic sculptor, and that's what. And then they have this big corridor full of these Greek and Roman things that are really gift shop artists. It's like gifts. It's a disgrace.
The Met's
to have those
grand new classical wing.
Yeah, those classical stuff. They're so crummy next to great sculpture. And I'm looking at these Degas, and I'm saying,
"You mean the 19th century, the neoclassical?"
No, I mean the old stuff.
Okay, okay.
The neoclassic stuff is like kitsch. It's kind of fun. No, but the old things, the only interest I had in them was the angle of the ass on the men. If it's sharp, that means he's for action. If it's soft, it means he's for fun. And that's the only interest I have in those sculptures.
I hope someone's writing this down.
Kind of disgraceful that a city like New York that has that, and has a corridor with the Rodins. The plaster, the marble Rodins look like soap sculpture to me. And the paintings look like really furniture store.
Okay, let's get back to these paintings.
We have
good colleagues at the Met.
So when I looked at the Degas, I said, I'd like to do these gestures in a modern form. And I had photographs out of a book. I brought them up to Maine. I called the ICA and said, "Do you have a model who's a dancer?" And they said, "Yes." And they sent over a model. I played the photographs on the floor. she did all the poses perfectly because it's like a 300-year-old system of poses. It comes from the Comedy d'Art when they started with one gesture and two gestures. And anyhow, and I put them in a modern context with splits, and I wanted to do the nude outdoors too. So I started, but I wanted it to be abstract. So the hard part was getting the color, the green. And it started out with the first ones were too dark, and then it was too ordinary, and then I finally got the green I wanted and did this whole series.
This is not unlike the green behind the Ada.
Yeah, it's like that green. Mm-hmm. It's from a green from the 50s of the idea of the green. I did Ada in a white dress a long time ago.
Green with a
and
little...
I loved that green, and I never got it again.
It's
and I was trying to get it.
Yellow, got yellow.
But this is a little it's acidy though.
Yeah.
And a little heavier.
So this is one set of paintings in the show, and there are more of these. And then there are these landscapes you were talking about.
Yeah, this is my third attempt at this. And this painting is misleading because it's 10 by 14 or 16 feet. And the paint is very fresh. And what I wanted to do was paint shadows on the grass. I wanted to do something which I thought was extremely ambitious. And I wanted to do it 10 by 20 feet. So I did one, it was 9 by 18, 3 years ago. And I didn't get what I wanted. Everyone loved the painting and subsequently went out. And then I tried it again the year later. And it wasn't any better than the first one in achieving what I wanted. People liked the painting, but I didn't get the feeling I wanted of the grass. And this is the third attempt at it. And the painting, everyone's crazy about the painting. I still didn't get what I wanted. It's a little closer than the first two. I don't know if I'll ever try it again. But that's the story. But the paint on there is really direct. I did a lot of sketches and paintings 4 feet by 3 feet and small things. Put them all on and painted this. And it just went its own way. I just followed the paint, so to speak. The paint was going on great. This is wet and wet. The whole canvas is painted yellow. And then I take a pot of green, and I painted light, and then I painted the dark. And the paint just went on great. And I followed the paint and got through with it very fast. And I was surprised how many people like it.
So do you know, can you put in words where it fell short?
Huh?
Where did it fall short? What are you still unhappy?
It doesn't look like the image of the shadows on the grass that I wanted.
Oh, okay. See, you're not capturing.
I had an image of shadows on the grass, not of making a painting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And that's the first time in my life anything like that. I couldn't do. It started with a painting of 15, 20 years ago, a sketch where I did it and couldn't figure out how to make it bigger. And then it just kept nagging me, so I went back to it and to try it. And I don't know, I might try it again, I don't know.
Well, the grass is yellow, is that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's light, it's the sunlight on the grass.
All right.
I'm painting from
that's
life.
Not
all the
problem,
sketches,
of, no.
all the sketches
the problem.
Are from life.
Okay.
I'm just matching the colors.
Yeah. So some night scenes. Looking
these
up into the trees.
Yeah. These are big paintings. They're 9 by 18 feet, and they're done directly, and it's from perception of twilight. Twilight, I'm painting twilight. And this is more realistic, actually. And the other one, the red one, is more like an idea about it. I've started that. About a year ago, I did a last show I had, I did a painting that was all yellow, and it was 12 foot tall and 8 foot wide. And I was painting the idea of the light rather than the sensation. I never did it before, and I thought it was a bad idea. The painting came out great, you know? And so I said I couldn't do another one like it. I just filed it away. And it meant something I would try out when the things got clicked together. And they clicked together on the red one, mm-hmm. where, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's an idea of twilight rather than the sensation. I mean, the other one was really like looking at it. This is more the idea of it. The figuration is sort of realistic, but that's the sensation. And basically, my paintings were trying to paint the sensation of what you see rather than the actuality, you know, of it. And that happened a long time ago. A friend of mine, Dick Crockett, was 2 years older and more advanced than I. The block I grew up in Queens, there were three artists, you know? And Dick was precocious, very talented illustrator type. And we went out and made watercolors. We bicycled 20 miles to find a view. We found the scenery, we came back. We showed them to my father. My father looked at Dick's and said, "Terrific, you're gonna be a great commercial artist." He looked at mine and said, "It's hopeless. You're going to have to be a fine artist." and he said, also, he said, "Hey, why do you paint scenes? Why don't you paint your own backyard?" And I really hated him. but then think of it, like, today I'm completely dominated by him.
You've just been painting your backyard for a long time.
Painting the backyard for a long time. Mm-hmm. That was a great, mm-hmm. great advice.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, show the other. Show a couple of those other things. They're kind of interesting.
Okay.
I think you might be
interested.
We're not
going anywhere. Because he said so, so we can stay.
Just show a couple of. The one on the left is the same thing. This is like perceptual, and the one on the right is the same thing. It's a cross light, where what you see is gets very dark, because the sun's going across it, and you can't see the painting on these. The one on the, they're both like consummately controlled, and the one on the right is like absolutely one of those perfect paintings in terms of technique. You got something else? There's a couple
yeah.
more.
So since we're going on, I'm going to drill down.
I'll just
here.
Go a couple of minutes. I'll show yeah. you the whole show. Oh, that's just that one.
That one. Talk about
these
that
paintings
one.
Are 10 and a half, and this is sunrise. And I got up in the morning and went to the bathroom, looked out the window and saw this. And I said, "This is fantastic. I've never seen anything like it," because it was 5:30 in the morning. And so I went back the next day with a camera, with a panel to paint it. And I painted it. It was very dull. You know, the actual thing, I didn't get anything like it. So this is like, and then the painting itself ran away, like the yellow one. And it became the sensation of what I was seeing. It didn't have too much, it wasn't literal at all at that point. I was very pleased with, that's it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, there's a lot going on here because you've got the perception, the sensation, and the idea.
That's right, yeah.
Right,
yeah.
And sometimes you're painting out of one or the other or the other.
Yeah,
yeah.
That's right.
And they can all work. They can all work, but the sensation is the heart of it for you.
Yeah, the right? sensation is what you're after.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you don't want it to be descriptive.
Mm-hmm. But sometimes to get the sensation, you have to go to the idea.
The idea starts first.
Okay.
You have an idea, a conception of what mm-hmm. you want to do, and then you try to work it out. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right, though.
But the sensation is always... not just the perception, it's really how you take it in,
yeah.
which is a great modernist idea, certainly yeah. going back to Manet and the Impressionists.
I say this stuff is, in a sense, traditional.
Mm-hmm. It's how it affects you. It's how you're seeing it in a complete way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, I just wanted to clear that up. There's... more stunning things. And then a couple of little trees at the end.
I got away with it.
Uh-huh. There's a little tree and there's
another
one.
That's only
7 by 9.
I got away with that too.
Yeah. And
that was actual like seeing something.
Uh-huh.
It's in the spring and somehow the grass is white. Mm-hmm. You know, But you don't have to show anymore.
And there you go with the cropping.
Oh, yeah, see? Uh-huh.
Yeah. So it's so rare that one gets a chance to talk to one of one's heroes.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, now, anybody who does not have a question or does not want to hear a question can leave, but we've got two microphones on either side, so we're going to do this a little bit formally so the people who are live streaming can hear the questions. So, you're up.
Oh, okay. So I was interested initially in the beginning of your talk. You talked about atmosphere and how in your painting of Irving and Lucy, that was a really important thing for you. Could you describe a little bit more about how atmosphere has developed over your career?
Well, initially it was to try to make flat surfaces have atmosphere. I did a lot of collages, you know, that. And now it's like, I don't think about it, it just happens. Mm-hmm. It's like muscle memory.
So you
I see that way. I see. Mm-hmm. I see with it some atmosphere. I find that a lot of impressionist paintings have too much atmosphere for me. Mm. They get a little soft. You know?
But you can't really paint flat now, even if you wanted to. There's always some sense of air and space.
Yeah, it's not hard. It's never hard. Mm-hmm. Hard concrete.
Okay, and there's a question over here from James Meyer.
Yes, I wanted to ask you about the double Ada. How did you come to make a double image? And you mentioned you wanted a non-psychological portrait. What is that for you, and
well,
why did you
at
want
the
to
time,
do it?
At the time, people were making psychological double portraits. You know, Kokoschka and other people, and they write about the psychological relationships. And for me, psychology was like undesirable and old-fashioned. So I wanted to make something that had no psychology in it at all. So that's how the double Ada came.
And just so you know, in the double Ada or these double portraits, it's almost the same figure just painted twice,
yeah.
side by side. Whereas in these earlier double portraits you're talking about, there would be different views, or there would be
The early ones, like flat, and I tried to paint.
No, I mean Kokoschka and...
Kokoschka's, yeah, they had all the story with the... Okay. All the story with...
So you wanted a very...
I wanted to know. I don't want any stories on the painting.
Okay.
The stories take the paintings out of the immediate present. Yeah, okay? Like Gertrude Stein and St. Augustine say the same thing. There is no past, there is no future, there's only the present. And that's what I'm trying to paint is the immediate present. And if you have a narration, it's no longer immediate. And so all narrative art is not uninteresting to me to paint.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
No stories.
But the double Ada is also not immediate because it's not one perception, it's a repetition.
Yeah, it hasn't changed my ideas. Mm-hmm. If I saw the painting, the painting was better than my ideas, so you opened the ideas up. Yeah.
Okay. Okay, another question here.
Just a process question, but what drives your decision about whether to use a square canvas or rectangular or big, small?
Well, it has to do with the content. You know, and it has to do with the idea. There are some things that are vertical ideas and some things are horizontal ideas. And so landscapes are generally horizontal ideas. So I made a lot of vertical paintings of landscapes, like the tree. You know, so the landscape is vertical. You know, you don't want to be conventional.
Okay, one more over here.
Thank you both so much. You spoke about how the visualization technologies of our time structure the way that we see, and I was wondering how you get out from under that sort of technology of the time.
Out of what?
So if the visual technologies of the time influenced how we see.
I'm influenced by visual technology. I mean, the splits that I'm doing now with the Degas all come out of advertising, looking at advertising. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the Jessen thing came out of looking at fashion magazines and stuff like that. Yeah. So, you know, I'm affected by all the visual material, just like everyone here is. Mm-hmm. We're living in a time where the it's getting more visual and less verbal. You know, the language is degenerating, mm-hmm. but the verbal thing is like everyone's very, very very visual. You know.
And I think the question was kind of about how to resist that, but you don't want to resist that.
No, I'm part of it. Yeah. Part of it. That's kind of interesting. I find it interesting. I have no resistance to it at all.
Okay. Yes, over here.
Hi, Mr. Katz. I want to thank you, first of all, for this lecture. I really enjoyed it. One of the things I've always been interested in your work is the relationship between your work and Fairfield Porter. And I know that I've read that he is a big fan of yours. I was just wondering if you had any Fairfield Porter stories.
Well, first of all, Fairfield Porter was in the middle of an abstract expressionist show, and I thought it was terrific. And he has a really almost dumb way of painting. It has no style. And I thought that was kind of terrific because there were a lot of stylized paintings that were around, you know? And so I met him, and he came over, and we found we disagreed on every painter. He liked de Kooning, I liked Pollock. I liked Rothko, he liked Motherwell, etc., right down the line. He's kind of the guy who's could keep a painting alive for a week, you know? Which I thought was kind of really interesting. I couldn't. I have to do it. If I don't do it direct, you can just throw it away. Mm-hmm. Is that enough?
I could take more, but I'll let you pass it back. Thank you very much.
What did he say?
He said he could take more, but he'll let you go. Sir.
I'm just wondering how all of the paintings of Ada come about. She probably has things to do, and are they spontaneous? Are they sort of like, okay, you're gonna, can you pose for me for a certain number of hours tomorrow, or are they spontaneous, or how do they happen?
Well, it's a whole confluence of things, and what it is Ada's like a perfect model. That's one thing. And I started with her because it was trying to paint someone, be detached from someone you're emotionally involved with. That's the first section. The second section is Ada went to movies a lot in the 40s. And somehow or other, all her gestures come from movies. She doesn't make a bad gesture. So it's like having a dancer or an actress in front of you. They know exactly where they're doing, but it's all muscle memory. So by looking at it, it all became part of everything she stands. Every time she moves, it's another picture. So that's it. So I have a great-looking model who makes perfect gestures. So I put her in a lot of different roles. She could be a housewife, she can be a femme fatale, she can be an ordinary lady. She's all these different ladies. I just cast her. And the poor thing has to suffer through posing, which is not interesting. But that's the story. Is that enough?
Thank you, yes.
Do we have maybe, is that a last question? Yes.
Hi, you mentioned that you went to Cooper Union in your youth, and I was just wondering how your art education shaped your career and your style? Like, would it have been any different had you not gone to art school?
What did he say?
Would it have been different if you had not gone to Cooper Union, had not gone to art school?
I don't think
at all?
I would. I don't think I didn't have the confidence or the connections to things to ever get anywhere. If I didn't go to Cooper, if I didn't go to art school. But I had 3 years was enough. That's what Cooper was. But there's no way I could get in real contact with it. We might have gotten there, but it would have taken a lot longer. Because I was, most of the artists you don't know the artists of your generation who are going to be really have some interest until they're 35 or 45. That's when the serious artists mm-hmm. become dominant.
Yeah.
And I was doing stuff like when I was like almost 30, really styled.
Mm. We have to give Alex time to sign all the books you bought, but there is one question from the middle here, last one.
Any thoughts about your early experiences at Skowhegan? Can you tell us?
Oh, I had a great time.
The question is about Skowhegan School. Yeah.
What they said was, by the time I was finished at Cooper Union, I was like a great art student because I wasn't trying to express myself. I was just trying to do it, do what they said, more or less, in my own way. And so they offered me the scholarship. They said, you can go to Yale or Cooper Union. Or Skowhegan, and Bill King, the previous guy, went to Skowhegan, had a great time, and it was one more week, so I said, let's go to Skowhegan, you know? And so Skowhegan was this regional art school, and so I come there in a double-breasted houndstooth jacket, right? And I see all these guys in leather jackets and jeans. It was a real culture shock. And then they got a dance, and they played Carmen Caballero, music from hotel bands, and no idea what to do with it. Because I come from the jazz thing where you could dance halftime Lindy Hops. You can only dance with someone from Queens or Harlem. You couldn't dance with anyone in the world. And this was like, there was a guy who was a sailor, Blackie Langley, and he could dance to anything with anyone. And we just all copied his style. So I had a great time. It was kind of interesting because I was like a provincial from Queens. Yeah. Right. That was it.
Great note to end on. Thank you very much, Alex.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.